Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Bird Brother, A Falconer's Journey and the Healing Power of Wildlife, by Rodney Stotts with Kate Pipkin. Read by James Foey. Chapter 1. I sat on the couch, lit a cigarette, and waited for tea to come in from the back room with my 8-ball of cocaine. The smell of sulfur from the match still tickled my nostrils as I pulled on the cigarette. The first drag is always the best. The way it fills your lungs with a warmth that spreads through your body and seems to give your mind everything it needs. I knew I needed to quit, but not today. Although the room was air-conditioned, I leaned back and wiped my forehead with the back of my hand, still recovering from the suffocating mid-August heat and humidity of southeast Washington, D.C. T had offered me a gin and tonic before he left the room, but I would have preferred an icy glass of really sweet tea. Maybe I would make some when I got home. I've never really had a taste for alcohol, except for the occasional beer, and of course I never broke the number one rule of any smart drug dealer. Do not use your product. Ever. But sugar and sweet drinks, those were my addictions. And cigarettes. And dealing dope. T had a nice apartment. I was pretty sure he didn't live there, just kept it as a meeting place. But that wasn't my business anyway. My 9mm pistol was poking into my back, but I didn't want to take it out and put it on the table. T knew I was armed, but a move like that could be misunderstood as some sort of threat. The relationship between two drug dealers and their transactions has to be carefully navigated and controlled. Say the wrong thing, make the wrong move, and you might get a mark put on your back. My MO was to stay calm and relaxed, but alert, always looking around like a hawk. "Okay, Rodney, let's get down to business," T said as he came back to the room with a broad smile and sat down across from me in a director's chair with shiny metal arms. He put a plastic bag and a triple beam scale on the table between us. At that time, 1992, digital scales weren't around much, but the triple beam gave a precise measurement. "What happened to your hand, man?" T asked, pointing to the bandage wrapped around my left hand. "Drive-by," I said. "I was seeing this girl down at Condon Terrace, and you know how it goes, some idiot with a gun, pissed at one person, but shooting at everybody." "You go to the hospital?" T and I looked at each other, and we both busted out laughing at the joke. Everybody knows that if you go to the hospital with a gunshot wound, the cops are going to be called. Unless you're about to die, you don't go. "It's not that bad," I said. "The bullet went clean through my hand, so there wasn't even much blood." It had hurt like hell, but I didn't admit that to T. "Dang, dog, Condon Terrace Projects, that's a danger zone, all right." My nickname at the time was Dog because I had pit bulls. They were my pets, and I loved them like my children. But I had also trained them well, so they served the double purpose of keeping people at a distance. T and I talked for a few more minutes about the perils of drive-by shootings, which were practically a daily occurrence in Southeast D.C., and then T said, "Okay, let's do this." He was a serious businessman and didn't like wasting his time. Neither did I. He used a small spoon to measure out the white powder and gestured for me to sample. I put my pinky finger on my tongue and then gently dipped it in the coke. I rubbed the powder along the gums above my upper teeth and then on the gums of my lower jaw until I felt the familiar tingle and numbness. "Oh yeah, that's good," I said. "I am to please," T said with a laugh. And just as T started to spoon the coke onto the scale, a large shadow passed by the side window. "What was that?" I said, standing up and walking over to the window. T ignored me, focused on measuring the coke. The window looked out on an empty, overgrown lot, strewn with empty bottles and crumpled fast food bags. Then I saw it. On the edge of the roof of an abandoned house next door, just about 10 yards away, a huge hawk, with a rodent dangling from its white curved beak. The bird tilted its head and looked at me with intense golden eyes. This creature was impressive. I didn't know it at the time, but I was looking at a red-tailed hawk, one of the most common hawks in North America. I'd always been fascinated by birds, especially the big ones like hawks, owls, falcons, eagles, and vultures. The first large bird I ever saw was a bald eagle. I must have been in the third or fourth grade, and our class went on a trip to the National Zoo on Connecticut Avenue in Woodley Park. The wingspan of that eagle was close to 8 feet. Its curved yellow beak was imposing, and it had wicked sharp talons from which almost nothing would escape death. The white feathers on its head rippled across the tops of his eyes, making him look proud and defiant. For a kid like me from the DC housing projects, this was mesmerizing. And so began my obsession with raptors. They were fierce. They were deadly. They were respected. That's what I aimed to be. And now, with my guns and dogs, I was. It wasn't just large birds that fascinated me as a child. From the beginning, animals and curiosity about them were a major part of my life. Even growing up in the dirty, violent streets of Southeast, a connection to nature always ran through my body, as natural as the blood in my veins. If I had to guess, I'd say it came from my mom's side. Her grandmother had a farm in Falls Church, Virginia. Cows, pigs, chickens, ducks, you name it, it was on my great-granny's farm. Sometimes Mom would take us there on weekends. The smell of hay, manure, fresh earth, and animal made me laugh out loud. I don't know why, it just made me so happy. Whenever we went to the farm, I felt like I was home, not only in a physical way, but in my heart, like my heart was home. That's also why I couldn't resist hooking school and going to the zoo at Woodley Park. When I was old enough, about 13 or 14, I'd hop the bus to 10th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue, get on the subway, transfer at Metro Center, and then walk the 10 blocks up to the zoo. It took about an hour to get there. Almost as impressive to me as the raptors were the big animals. Elephants, tigers, lions, hippos. They had power. You had to respect them. I began to understand at an early age that human relationships with anything wild require three things. Love, patience, and most of all, respect. It sounds simple, but I would eventually learn that it's not easy at all. If something is untamed and wild, then it has a spirit that can't be crushed. That doesn't mean we should be afraid of it. It just means we have to take the time to learn about it and understand it. Once we understand the wild things, we understand ourselves. At least that's what ended up happening with me. I was still at the window watching that hawk. It worked its prey back and forth in its beak until just the tail was hanging out, and then that was gone. We looked at each other, and the hawk let out a raspy scream that I could hear even through the closed window. I think it was proud to have an audience. He looked around for a moment, then spread its huge wings and took off with his red-orange tail feathers outspread. I pressed my face against the window so I could watch him glide in a rising current of air. I almost felt like I was flying away with him, beyond the rooftops, beyond the housing projects, beyond this drug deal, beyond the death and destruction. "Hey, Rodney, what's out there? You want to finish this up or what?" "Yeah, man, yeah, yeah." I walked back over to the couch and took a close look at the scale. It looked like a perfect measurement of 7 grams to me. I pulled a roll of $100 bills from my pocket and counted out $1,500, trying to avoid any pressure on my bandaged hand. "Here you go, man," I said, handing T the money. "Much obliged," T said with a laugh, carefully putting my dope into a glass vial. "See you in 2 weeks, dog." "You know it," I said. I put the vial in my pocket, shook hands with T, and headed back into the heat. At this time, the early 1990s, the city was still festering from the crack epidemic that had started in the late 80s. The lure of the drug crawled through and in and over the endless blocks of the DC housing projects like roaches in the cereal cupboard. Vacant-eyed addicts roamed the streets in search of the next hit. Even my mother was addicted to crack. Young guys like me, our lives could go in one of only three directions. Professional athlete. Come on, get real. Drug user, and lose all control over your life? No thanks. Or drug dealer, make good money, but either get shot and killed or go to jail. I chose door number 3. I was never a street dealer. That was for people who wanted some quick cash rather than serious money. I didn't have time for the foolishness of street cred, turf wars, and stick-up boys, and they're the punks who robbed the street dealers. I wanted to stay alive, and I wanted to make money. My business was on a higher level. I only bought good dope from serious dealers, and I only sold dope to serious dealers. In the hierarchy of drug dealers, I guess you could say I was mid-level. But my housing was keeping me from growing my drug business, and I needed to do something about it quick. I was living in my mom's apartment at the Linda Pollan Memorial Housing Projects. It was called Linda Pollan after real estate magnate Abe Pollan's daughter, who had died of a rare heart condition. A roomy public housing development for working-class black folks opened in the late 60s. We called it the LP. People who had lived in the LP for a long time told me it had started going downhill in the 1980s, mostly because of tenant turnover, management problems, and endless maintenance issues. And then, like a thunderclap, came the crack cocaine epidemic. I dove right into the opportunity to make some good money. I remember laughing at a 1991 Washington Post article that called the LP the most lethal block in the city. The other dealers and I felt a weird pride about that tag. After all, what else did we have to be proud of? But not having my own apartment was cramping my style. I needed more guns, but it would have been disrespectful of me to keep such an arsenal at my mom's place. My mom, Mary, aka Dippy, knew what I was doing, and she worried about me all the time. I could see it in her face, even when she was high. Whenever she talked about my drug dealing, her eyes grew dark. She worried about my older brother Chuck as well, especially when he drove up to New York to buy dope. He wasn't a street dealer either. Mostly he just sold to the female strippers at the club where he bounced. In addition to more guns, I needed to be able to make deals from my own place on my own turf. The challenge was that most apartments wanted to see a few pay stubs to prove that a person could afford the rent. I could definitely afford it. I had thousands of dollars stashed away. But you don't get pay stubs or a W-2 from dealing drugs. A buddy of mine had told me about a job fair happening at a community center of the nearby Valley Green Housing Project, and I decided to check it out. One table had a bunch of job listings and applications, and I found two that interested me. One was a maintenance position. My mom always gave me, Chuck, and my sisters cleaning chores growing up, so I knew I could do that, at least for a couple of months, so I could show some pay stubs. The other was a job with a group called Earth Conservation Corps, ECC, cleaning out the Anacostia River. That sounded good because ever since I was a kid, if I had to choose between being outside or inside, it didn't matter how cold or hot it was, rain or shine, I wanted to be outside. Other kids might be inside watching TV, but I would rather be outside looking up at the sky. Something about rolling clouds, vast sky, and birds flying overhead spoke to me. But nature was like a foreign language. I wanted to understand the message it was trying to convey. I just couldn't make sense of the words. The ECC people called me back first, so I accepted the position on the river. I was already familiar with the Anacostia. When I was little, our family would have cookouts at Anacostia Park. We'd swim in the river or just hang out with a bucket of KFC. Of course, we knew it was a general dumping ground for trash, but we didn't know how toxic the river really was. Anyway, I went home and told my mom about the job. She was glad I was embarking on a legit job, even though she knew I would keep hustling. That was inevitable, as there was no way I could go from making several thousand dollars a week to 100. I was to start the new gig in a few days. I didn't know it then, but I was about to start learning the mysterious language of the birds and the sky and the ever-changing Anacostia River. Chapter 2, 2017. Every once in a while, the Anacostia River still weaves its way into my dreams. Not in a big, bold, rushing, tumbling, splashing, symbolic kind of way. More like a quiet, in the background but always there way. That's how it was this morning, right before I woke up. In the dream, I'm 21 again, in the river with Monique. She is still alive. And we are struggling to pull a dirty, waterlogged mattress out of the river. We're both wearing hip-high waders and rubber gloves that the Earth Conservation Corps has given us. We need someone to help us, Rodney, says Monique, breathing heavily from the exertion. Nah, Monique, we got this. We're strong enough. It really is heavy, but no way am I going to admit that to Monique. I want to impress her with my strength, but this soaked mattress is brutal. I take a few backward steps up the riverbank, grab the top of the dripping mattress, and pull while Monique stands in the water and pushes. Just a little bit more, I huff, accentuating each word with a yank on the mattress as if that will give me some extra strength. Finally, the waterlogged mattress comes out of the river. As I take my final few steps, I slip in the mud and fall on my back, the mattress covering my legs. Monique, you pushed too hard, I shout, but the scene is so ridiculous that I can't help but bust out laughing. Oh, you can take it, says Monique, climbing out of the water. You just said we were strong enough. She flops on her back next to me in the swampy mud, and we both start laughing. In the dream, our laughter floats up to the cloudless summer sky in the form of cartoon-like musical notes. I wake with a start. I'm breathing heavily, and it takes me a second to realize where I am. These dreams always seem so real. Oh, Monique, I say to no one in particular, rubbing my eyes. I wish you were still here. I know that if I don't get up right away, the image of us finding Monique's lifeless body will come rushing back to me, and I can't have that chasing me all day when her murder already haunts me most nights. I throw back the blanket and walk into my compact bathroom. I brush my teeth, wash my face with soap and cool water, and stare at my reflection in the small mirror. No time for river memories today, old man, I say to my reflection. My sparse beard is flecked with gray. I'm 46, after all, but I'm totally content with whom I see in the mirror. I didn't always feel that way, though. If anyone had told me 25 years ago that at age 46, I would be a master falconer caring for and training my own birds of prey, I would have laughed. Not so much about the falconry part. I've always loved animals, but mostly because I never expected to live that long, not with the life I was living. I pull on the jeans and sweatshirt that are hanging over a chair and step into my worn, unlaced Timberland boots. It might be time to splurge on a new pair soon. Got things to do, I say. I'm so used to talking to the birds, horses, and my dog all day that I end up talking to myself as well. I step out of my trailer and shiver. It's only late September, but there's a bite of fall in the air. The sun is rising, but the chill has wrapped itself around the morning air. My horses, birds, and I live on property owned by the D.C. government near the Patuxent Wildlife Refuge. Where I live has been designated as an animal sanctuary, and that's what it is. It's a sanctuary for me as well, because, given the choice, I prefer to be around animals over people any day. The Capital Guardian Youth Challenge Academy is also on the property. It's a 5.5-month program based on traditional military training for young men and women who, I guess you could say, have lost their way, or are very close to losing their way. They've dropped out of high school, they're getting into trouble, maybe hanging out with the wrong crew, or starting to try drugs. I see them as young people who crave change. They're desperate to either get out of their situation or reach for something better, but they feel like no matter what direction they go, it's the wrong one, and they don't know what to do. As part of their time with Capital Guardian, they have to do an internship with me, learning about wildlife, cleaning out cages, feeding the horses, and building aviaries. If they've used up any chances that they may have been given by anyone, as often as not, Capital Guardian is their last hope to figure out how to build a life. That's kind of what Earth Conservation Corps helped me do, so I can relate to them. I also connect with them because I dropped out of high school during my junior year after getting in trouble with the police. When I see the kids from Capital Guardian, I see myself when I was that age, thinking I knew everything, but deep down inside wanting to see some kind of path for myself that wasn't covered with thorny brambles and weeds. Here's the thing. When you grow up with limited means in the inner city, with or without a stable family, and you're surrounded by the bounty the drug dealing brings, and you're stuck in a shitty educational system that offers only a fraction of what rich kids get in their counties, you end up carrying all of the baggage that comes with that. And it's heavy. Heavy like the wet mattress from my dream. Most crumple under the weight. Working with the Capital Guardian kids means I get to do two of my favorite things. Fly my Raptors, and show young people that they have options in their lives. They just have to keep an eye out for what ignites their heart, which sounds easier than it is. On this particular day, like most others, I pull out my way too crowded key ring and fumble for the right key to the door of the storage building behind the trailer. This is where I keep feed for my four rescue horses, food for my Raptors, and an assortment of carriers, extra gloves, jesses, and other falconry-related equipment. I grab a plastic bin out of the full-size refrigerator, open it, and pull out a handful of dead white mice. Only the best freshly thawed mice for my birds, I say out loud to no one. As a licensed master falconer living close to Washington, D.C., I'm able to obtain uncontaminated rats, mice, and small birds from the Invigo laboratories at the National Institutes of Health. Because they've been bred at NIH, I know they are safe and not poisoned in any way. They arrive frozen, and I thaw them out for my raptors. Mice are what they eat in the wild, along with other rodents and rabbits. It's important that captive raptors be fed the same kind of diet they would eat if they were living in the wild. You can't just go to the grocery store and buy some raw meat. There's not enough nutrition in that for raptors. I grab my leather glove that I need to handle the birds and the bunch of dead mice, and I'm ready to head across the lawn to the aviary. The mice bodies will stay fresh for a while because they aren't sitting out in 80 or 90 degree heat. I'll feed the raptors first and then the horses. The five Harris's hawks I have now are Agnes, Nanny, Gloria, Chuck, and Squeal. Harris's hawks are social birds and even work together in the wild to get food. Agnes is my heart bird, given to me by a special person, Agnes Nixon, who was one of my staunchest supporters until her death last year. A sweet and docile Nanny and Moody Gloria are named after two of my deceased aunts. Chuck is named after my older brother. And my soldier Squeal is named for my buddy Billy Morris. I whistle to the birds as I make my way toward the aviaries. Time for breakfast, y'all, I call out. Three aviaries are located in a semi-restored 100-year-old barn. Two other aviaries are connected to the visitor's center where I give presentations to various groups. I built all of the aviaries with help from friends and people from Earth Conservation Corps. This is a good spot for birds because one of the first things dedicated falconers must be sure they have is space. If a falconer is going to fly a red-tailed hawk, for example, then several acres of available fields are needed. I would discourage anyone from thinking about becoming a falconer unless they have located the right kind of space with natural prey like rabbits or small birds, depending on what your raptor hunts. First up to get fed are Nanny and Gloria. I unlock the outside door, shut it behind me, and then unlock the wood door to the first aviary. I created the double door entry to make sure the birds are safe from external disturbances. The United States Fish and Wildlife Service has general rules for aviary construction and maintenance, and officers from the Maryland Natural Resources Police come out regularly to check on my aviaries and the condition of my birds to make sure I'm complying with all of the regulations. Nanny and Gloria are in one of the larger aviaries, sitting on perches across from one another. I imagine them gossiping and laughing with each other when I'm not around, just like my aunts used to do. With my gloved hand, I take one of the mice and hold it toward Nanny. Come on, Nance. She makes a little chirp and swoops across to land on my glove, grabbing the mouse with her curved beak. I shake my glove a little, and she flies back to her perch with her breakfast, the pink mouse tail hanging out of her mouth. I do the same thing with Gloria. Falconry is a seasonal sport. In the spring, my birds molt, dropping their old feathers and getting new growth. Falconers don't hunt their raptors in spring and summer because it's too easy to lose them in all of the foliage. During that time, we feed them mice and keep them healthy. Around late August and September, I begin to feed them less and drop their weight to get them ready to hunt from about November through February. They have to be hungry when I fly them so that they return to me. That's why they don't get too much to eat today. Falcons in captivity have a much higher chance for survival than those in the wild. It's safer for them to live in captivity because their chance of getting killed by cars or hunters is much lower, and the food they eat is safer. At this point in my life, I know different raptors and their habits, as well as I know the scars on my hands. I almost feel like I am one of them, although I'm not sure which one I'd be. Maybe I'm a Cooper's hawk, with its orange eyes and long, slender body. Or maybe a gerfalcon, the largest and fastest of all falcons, with a regal white tail. Gerfalcons mainly go for birds in flight, grabbing them in their beaks and breaking their necks so they die right away. Or maybe I'm just a regular old red-tailed hawk. Unlike falcons, most hawks are messy, mean killers. They sit in a tree and survey their surroundings on the watch for a tasty morsel. Once a hawk spots an unsuspecting rabbit or squirrel, it swoops down, uses its sharp talons to pierce the skin, and then starts ripping into the furry skin with its beak, basically eating the prey alive. Nature at its fiercest. That's the kind of stuff I think about when I'm working with my animals. The circle of life will always fascinate me more than any movie, book, or television show. Since I started working with birds, my motto has always been, look up. That's how you learn about birds and their habits. I've always taught my kids to look up. That's where you find the circle of life on full display. And if you're lucky, that's where you find hope. I leave the girls and head over to the barn to feed the rest of the birds. Right inside the door is a wall with a bunch of writing on it, lots of names and poems. I think of it as a kind of prayer or memory wall, and I place my hand on it for a moment. I started it a few years ago after construction of the aviaries was completed. I wrote my mom's name, Dippy, that was her nickname, and the names of other people I've known and loved who have passed. Over the years, I've invited every single person who comes to visit to write the name of a loved one they've lost on the wall. Doesn't matter who you are, everyone who comes here has lost someone they loved. This is a way to honor that person and keep their memory alive. It's a colorful, busy-looking wall, and it keeps energy and love flowing through the space. The aviaries are dedicated to those people who inspire us. I finish feeding my hawks, and an injured 23-year-old Eurasian eagle owl named Mr. Hoots, who belongs to Earth Conservation Corps but lives here for now. As I walk toward the field and stable to feed the horses, the cell phone in my pocket starts to vibrate. It's my 24-year-old son, Mike. Goober, I yell into the phone. We've been calling him that practically forever because when he was little, we thought his head was shaped like a peanut. What are you doing up this early? Dad, I need to talk to you, Mike says. Well, go ahead and talk then. I always like to get to the point at hand, especially with my kids. No sense in wallowing around in chit-chat. I want to become a falconer. I stop walking toward the horses. Say that again. Dad? I want to be a falconer. I let out a big scream of laughter, and I swear I can feel my chest swell a little. Well, dang, it's about time you finally admitted it. When do you want to start? Today. Well, all right, then. I guess I'll see you later today. I always knew that someday Mike would follow in my falconer footsteps. I just didn't know when. Even when he was little, I would see him watching birds with the same intent curiosity that I had. All right, Dad, I'll be over this afternoon. Mike pauses for a few seconds. I want to be a falconer, he says again. Like you. I know Mike is proud of me, of the man I have become. I can hear it in his voice. But everything was different some 15 years ago. Mike was only 8 when I got locked up on drug charges. He later told me how he cried when one day I was just suddenly gone. He had seen other men in the neighborhood and his friends' fathers get locked up and never return. Mike thought that now it was his father's turn and that I might not be back.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?